everyone, and welcome to Tara Tea. I'm your host, Tara, and today begins our Stabathon. Yes, we are finally going over the Scream series, which means that Scream 2022 is only 5 weeks away. So today we are beginning with 1996's Scream. Scream originally came out on October 20th, 1996. It revitalized Wes Craven's career. It put Kevin Williamson on the map as basically the pulse of 90s teen dialogue. If you're a longtime listener, then you know Scream is my absolute favorite horror movie, and I am beyond excited to do this deep dive into the series. There's gonna be a ton of spoilers. This movie's 25 years old, people. Like, if you're getting spoiled by Scream from my podcast, why did you listen to it? Like, watch the movie first. I am not gonna do it justice. I do want to say thank you to everyone who's had patience with the podcast. We've had a couple of delays. I've mentioned it kind of in passing that I live in Kentucky, and I do live where the tornadoes hit. Everybody that I know, friends, family, we're all okay. Didn't have power the night that it hit. It came back up early that morning. Was without internet for a day and a half. And I work in insurance, and so it's been a chaotic week. Well, almost 2 weeks at this point. But it's been nuts. And taking that time to spend extra time with my family and checking in on my dad and all of that was just honestly more important than recording an episode for the podcast. Nothing personal. I love that you guys listen and I love doing the podcast, but real life was more important in that moment. So we're gonna start with Scream. I'm kind of gonna give a rundown real fast of what's gonna be happening in the next few weeks. So this week we're getting Scream right before New Year's Eve. We will see Scream 2, and then the next week's that first week of January, we see Scream 3. And then that week that Scream 2022 comes out is when we're going to cover Scream 4. And then, of course, that next week, so we're looking at about the 19th, is when the episode should drop for Scream 2022. I am going to do a special that will hopefully come out on New Year's Eve if I can scramble up enough time. There will be a New Year's Eve episode where I will be recapping the episode we did at the beginning of the year where I was like, hopefully all these 2021 horror movies come out. We'll go over which ones I saw, which ones I didn't, my thoughts, and we're gonna try to dig in deep to see what's coming in 2022, what we're pumped about, what I'm like, I ain't watching that, what we're pumped about, what we're not so pumped about, maybe things that I don't know are coming out, or maybe you guys don't know how they're gonna be released. We're gonna try to find as much info we can, and we'll go over that. But that's about the gist of what we got going on. So let's go ahead and dig in to Scream. The movie begins with a phone ringing, because of course it does. We have Casey Becker, who's played by Drew Barrymore. She answers the phone and she thinks that it's the wrong number. She hangs up, but the guy calls back, saying that he just wanted to apologize. He tells her that he wants her to talk to him, and she tells him they got 900 numbers for that, which, depending on your age, you won't know what a 900 number is, but that's where you could call and do phone sex instead of looking it up online or whatever. So we get a quick shot of the house. We see the swing out front that's kind of swaying a little bit. Casey's making popcorn with Jiffy Pop. So that's where it's this little container. It's this little metal thing and has a handle. You sit it directly on the stove and then it expands like a bubble and the popcorn's inside. This popcorn is basically, the way they've explained it since, is that it is a clock for you to watch. And as the popcorn gets bigger and bigger and eventually catches fire and all this, that's how you know that the shit is about to hit the fan, is from this popcorn. It is our clock. So the phone rings. It's the same voice. She asks who it is, and he says that if she tells him her name, then he'll tell her his. And of course, Ghostface's voice is super seductive and all of this, but she refuses. He hears the popcorn, and he asks what she's making. She's like, oh, it's popcorn. He's like, oh, popcorn. I only eat that when I'm watching a movie. And she's like, well, I'm getting ready to watch a video. And so he's asking her what she's going to watch. She says that it's a scary movie. And so we get our question.
What's your favorite scary movie?
She tells him Halloween, the one with the guy in the white mask who stalks the babysitters. She asks his, and he asks her to guess. So she guesses Nightmare on Elm Street, and he asks if that's the one with the guy who has the knives for fingers. She confirms, yes, that's Freddy Krueger. He says he liked that movie because it was scary. She says that the first one was, but the rest sucked. And of course, Wes Craven created Nightmare on Elm Street. But he left the series until New Nightmare. And in actuality, Wes Craven wanted to pull this line. But because the rest sucked, including New Nightmare, the line was left in. Ghostface asks if she has a boyfriend, and she asks him very flirtatiously if he wants to ask her out on a date. He says maybe, and asks if she has a boyfriend. She says no. He asks her name, and she asks why he wants to know, and he says he wants to know who he's looking at. We see a dog bark, and she's like, what did you say? And he's like, I want to know who I'm talking to. She's like, that's not what you said. She's looking out the window, looking around. We see the pool. There's nothing out there. She looks to be safe. She tells him she has to go, and he says, we're supposed to go out. And she's like, no, I don't think so. And he threateningly tells her not to hang up on him, but it's too late. She's already pulled the phone away, and she hangs up. We cut to the popcorn. It's almost bursting open and is going to start catching fire. This, again, is our signal that it's about to go down. The phone rings again. She answers it, and he tells her that he said not to hang up on him. He said he wants to talk to her, and she tells him to dial someone else and hangs up. She's going through the house, and she's checking the doors, and just before she gets the popcorn off the stove, the phone rings again. She yells, listen, asshole! And suddenly, the voice on the phone is much angrier. He's like, no, you listen, you little bitch. If you hang up on me again, I'm gonna gut you like a fish. And then he laughs, and he gives this little, like, yeah. In my opinion, now I don't know if this is fact, but this is how my clue that Billy is the one talking to her on the phone. Because the mannerisms, like that kind of seductive and honestly like kooky mannerisms thing that Billy has later in the movie, I feel like this is Billy. Like Stu is more goofy and playful, whereas Billy is very calculated in his... in the way that he acts and his mannerisms and all that. And so I have always figured that this is Billy. And we will get into who I think did what at the end. She asks him if this is some sort of joke, and he tells her it's more like a game. And he asks her if she can handle it, and then he calls her Blondie. So she knows that he can see her at this point, starts running around locking all the doors. And this house has like four sets of doors. You've got the front door, you've got the patio door, but then there's like a back door, and then there's some other, she's locking like everything. I don't know like what she was doing when she was walking around the house the first time he creeped her out, but whatever. So she starts looking out the front door, and he asks if she can see him. She tells him that she's 2 seconds away from calling the police, and he says they'll never make it in time because we're in the middle of nowhere. She asks him what he wants, and he tells her that he wants to see what her insides look like. So she hangs up crying, and suddenly the doorbell rings. She screams and yells, who's there? She says she's gonna call the police, and when she goes to dial, the phone rings. She answers it, and Ghostface is telling her it's a death wish, you should never ask who's there. You know, don't you watch horror movies? She tells him that he'd better leave, or else her boyfriend will kick his ass. Ghostface says that he thought that she didn't have a boyfriend, and she admits that she lied. She screams, he's big, he plays football, and he'll kick the shit out of you. Ghostface asks if his name is Steve. She asks how he knows his name, and he tells her to turn on the patio lights again. So he was obviously watching when she was looking around the first time. So she looks outside, and we see that Steve is now duct taped to a chair in the front of the pool. He's roughed up, so it's very clear they attacked him when he arrived. She goes outside, and Ghostface tells her not to do that, and she quickly locks the door shut. Ghostface says he wants to play a game in case he refuses, so he says, fine, he'll die right now. Ghostface tells her to turn off the lights, and when she does, we hear Steve screaming no. And I am of the firm belief that one of the Ghostfaces, yes, again, we are in spoiler territory. I've already spoiled that Billy's the killer. Stu's the other one. There we go. One of these bastards are behind Steve, because you would be able to see behind him, but it's black, like especially down on the ground. So I think Ghostface is crouched behind him so he can hear them talking outside. And also when he kills him later, it's just like a quick slice. You don't see anybody running, so he's obviously behind the fucking chair. And later, when we go back out, you can see underneath the chair. So again, someone's hiding back there in the Ghostface costume. Casey ends up hiding behind the TV, unplugging the lamp to try to hide herself. Ghostface wants to do movie trivia, so he asks who the killer in Halloween is, and she tries to refuse, saying she can't do it. And he gives details about the movie and the killer, and then she remembers his name is Michael Myers. And he says, yes, excellent, great, now the real questions. He asks her to name the killer in Friday the 13th. She screams Jason over and over again. And I love the way he says this. He's like, I'm sorry, that's the wrong answer. And I don't know what it is about how he says it, I don't know. But I just love the way he says it. So she disagrees. She's like, no, I saw that movie 20 goddamn times. And he tells her, then you should know that Mrs. Voorhees was the original killer and that Jason didn't show up until the sequel. She tells him that he tricked her, and yeah, he absolutely fucking did. I think that if she would have said Mrs. Voorhees, he would have talked his way out of that one too. Ghostface says, lucky for her, there's a bonus question, but poor Steve is out. We hear Steve yell and look down, which helps prove my theory. And she turns on the light and we see his dead body. He has been sliced across the stomach. In actuality, this scene had to be cut down quite a bit because gravity was basically pulling his insides down, causing them to move around on screen. We do get a nice little intestine swing. That was the one thing the NPAA, I guess, would allow because they tried to cut this movie to shit. So Casey is obviously petrified. She tries to hide behind the TV in shock. Ghostface is laughing on the phone. And suddenly a chair is thrown through the glass door and it scares the shit out of me every time I watch this movie. Because the opening scene up until this point is relatively quiet. And from this point through the rest of this fucking movie, it is louder than hell. And so this jump scare has always scared me half to death. I finally got to see Scream in theaters a couple of months ago. I'd never seen the original Scream in an actual theater. I saw it during outdoor Q&A at a horror convention years ago, but I saw it like in a real theater. It was awesome. And I about jumped out of my seat when the chair went through the window or the glass door. It's still to this day, as many times as I've seen this movie, I know it's coming, it still scares me. So she runs in the kitchen, grabs a knife, backing away from the door. When she sees someone in a black cloak running through the hall, she ends up trying to sneak outside and she gets on the back porch. She can see Ghostface running around in the house looking for her. In the distance, we see a car coming down the road. Casey tries to sneak by a window, but when she raises up, Ghostface is right there. He breaks the window and grabs her hand and ends up shoving his body through the window, but she hits him in the face with her phone. Fun fact, that's director Wes Craven who took the phone to the face for this shot. It's the one time that he wears the costume in the film, and of course, he got hit in the face. So she takes off running past Steve's body and for whatever reason, stops. And she sees the car pulling in the driveway. So of course, Ghostface takes this opportunity to jump out and attack her. They take off running. He grabs her and he's able to stab her in the shoulder. And of course, this scene is always so fucking weird because they're running. And then as they're running, he kind of slows down, turns to look at her shoulder and stabs her. And if you notice, the cloak isn't all the way black in this scene. It's gray. And that is because they were shooting, trying to figure out the costume. And we'll get more into fun facts, but they were trying to figure out the costume. And so this was one of like 5 days they had Drew Barrymore that they were trying to figure out the costume. And so I don't necessarily think that this would have been the original, this would have been one of the more original takes and not one that they would have polished, because this whole thing is so fucking scary. Who cares about editing it for this brief moment in time? This scene is terrifying. But I do think it's interesting that the costume's a little different. So, falls to the ground, knocks his knife away, and he climbs on top of her and starts to choke her. She knees him in the groin and tries to crawl towards the car. It turns out it's her parents who have come home. Ghostface comes up behind her and she collapses on the patio. She removes his mask and he lifts the knife up high to stab her. There's a brief moment of shock, or no. Yeah, she removes his mask and he lifts his knife up high to stab her. There's a brief moment of shock on her face, and this is why I think Stu killed her. A lot of people are saying because Billy tends to choke that it has to be him, and yes, she would recognize her ex-boyfriend's best friend. But I think it was Billy on the phone and Stu doing the killing, because Billy has to go, technically, and we'll get into more where this is a little off. Billy, from what we see, goes straight to Sydney's house, so he can't be all scuffed up and shit. He can't be all sweaty, so I think it was Stu. So the parents get inside, they find the popcorn burning, and they start yelling for Casey. Mr. Becker tells Mrs. Becker to call the police. She grabs the phone and she realizes she can hear Casey being stabbed on the other line on the phone. We cut to Casey's body being dragged. Ghostface realizes she still has the phone and hangs up. Mr. Becker tells Mrs. Becker to drive down to the McKenzie's, which is a line from Halloween. That's where Jamie Lee Curtis is telling the kids, go to the McKenzie's, call for help. However, when Mrs. Becker gets outside, she screams, and we see that Casey's body has been hung up on the swing, and her insides are on the outside. So we get our title card, and we cut to Sydney Prescott, who is played by Neve Campbell, typing away on her computer. She hears a noise outside and looks out the window when her boyfriend Billy, played by Skeet Ulrich, scares her, causing her to scream. Her dad hears and comes to check on her, but her closet door blocks the bedroom door from opening. She lets him in and he tells her that he's out first thing in the morning, then the expo's gonna last till Sunday. He tells her that he is staying at the Hilton by the airport, and of course, all this information is super handy when you're framing someone for murder. It makes me wonder, did Billy luck in all this info right now? Or, because Sydney seems to already know, she's like, yeah, the Hilton, Had she already known all this and told him this, just being like, oh, my dad's gonna be out of town and he's staying over at the Hilton and all this shit. So, don't know. At the same time, like, you gotta hope your kid isn't sneaking someone in where you gotta talk in code. So Sydney closes the door and Billy raises up, saying that he's never snuck through her bedroom window before. He says he was watching The Exorcist and it got him thinking of her being edited for TV with all the good stuff taken out. It reminded him of how hot and heavy they started, a nice solid R rating on their way to an NC-17. He says something changed, which we later find out is the rape and murder of her mother. Like, fuck you, dude. He tells her he would never dream of breaking her underwear rule and asks if they can do on top of the clothes stuff. She agrees, they start making out, and of course he tries to go under her nightgown immediately. The only good part of this scene is the Don't Fear the Reaper cover. It was covered by Gus and is in the form of a ballad. I absolutely love it. It's on like my liked Spotify list. I love it. I listen to it all the time. She stops him and he's like, do you see what you do to me? And like every little idiot in high school said this shit. Like, it's very on point. But like as a 30-something year old woman, I'm just like, ugh. Because they all said this shit to their girlfriends or their boyfriends and bitched about blue balls. Like, suck it up, dill hole. So Sydney asks if he knows what her father will do to him, and Billy goes to leave. She tells him that she appreciates the romantic gesture, and he tells her that he's not trying to rush her and is only half serious, but that's all a fucking lie, because if she was willing to have sex with him right now, he would be having sex with her. Billy gave me bad vibes from the get-go. I always suspected that Billy was the bad guy and that he was the killer. So, as he's climbing out the window, she asks if he'll settle for a PG-13 relationship and flashes him. He calls her a tease and then leaves. We think this is cute and all, but the next time we see Neil Prescott, her dad, he's wearing the exact same clothes he's wearing in this scene. So not only did Billy sneak over and try to fuck his daughter, but he also immediately kidnapped him. And because they needed his phone, did they previously clone it? Or is the beginning out of order? Should it be Sydney's scene first and then Casey's chronologically? Do you need someone's phone to clone it? Like, how does that work? Especially in the 90s. Who the fuck knows? So we cut to Woodsboro High, and it is a mess of reporters, cop cars. It's total chaos. Sydney arrives at school unaware of what's going on. We hear a reporter talking about kids buying drugs and being involved in the occult. That reporter is Linda Blair of Exorcist fame. We'll get a full cameo from her soon. We hear Gail Weathers, being played by Courtney Cox, reporting on the two teenagers brutally murdered. She is wearing the brightest lime green skirt and jacket combo I've ever seen, and I am obsessed. Gail says that the authorities haven't arrested anyone, and the suspect could strike again. Tatum, played by Rose McGowan, comes up, and Sydney asks what's going on. She tells her that Steve and Casey were killed last night, and not like killed, but like splatter movie killed. Ripped open from end to end. Sydney says that Casey sits next to her in English, and Tatum's like, not anymore. Apparently, they're interrogating the entire school, and Dewey says that it's the worst crime they've seen in years, even worse than, And she pauses and just says, well, it's bad. In English, Sydney looks over at the empty desk where Casey used to sit, and suddenly it's Sydney's turn to be questioned. She arrives in the principal's office and they were just discussing that she's the mother of someone and trail off before naming who it is. Principal Hembree asks how she's feeling. She says she's okay, greeting Sheriff Burke and Dewey, who requests to go by Deputy Riley today. David Arquette plays Tatum's brother, who is the deputy for Woodsboro. Principal Hembree says they're gonna ask a few questions, and he grabs her chin and like holds her face in a weird way, and like Sheriff Burke notices, we notice, it's all fucking weird. So Burke asks if she was close to Casey, and then we cut to a little like courtyard shot with the voiceover of Principal Hembree on like the PA system saying to keep together, avoid strangers, goes in twos and threes. And then we see Billy, Sydney, Tatum, her boyfriend Stu, played by Matthew Lillard, and Randy, played by Jamie Kennedy, are all in the fountain discussing the questions they were asked. The guys were all asked if they hunted or if they liked to hunt, and Tatum asks why they would ask that. Randy says it was because their bodies were gutted, and she says that they didn't ask her if she liked to hunt. Stu says there's no way a girl could do that. Tatum says the killer could easily be female and references basic instinct. Randy says that that was with an ice pick, so it's not quite the same thing. Stu says that Casey and Steve were completely hollowed out and it takes a man to do something like that. Tatum says, or a man's mentality. Sydney asks how you gut someone, and Stu says that you slice them from groin to sternum. Billy gets on to him for being crass and upsetting Sydney. Sydney asks if he used to date Casey, and he says, yeah, he did for like 2 seconds. And Randy chimes in saying before she dumped him for Steve. Tatum's like, I thought that you dumped her for me. And Stu says, yeah, Randy's full of shit. So Randy asks if the police are aware that he dated the victim. And Stu asks what he's saying and if he's trying to say that he killed him. Tatum says that he was with her last night. And Randy asks if that was before he sliced and diced. Tatum asks where he was last night, and he says he was working at the video store. And she's like, I thought they fired your sorry ass. He's like, yeah, twice. So Stu says he didn't kill anyone, and Billy says, well, no one said you did. And he says it in this kind of weird way, which a lot of people think that that's Billy admitting that he did it. Just like, you know, no one's saying you did it, because we both know I did it. But I still think that it was Stu. So Randy's like, because yeah, it takes a man to do something like that. Basically implying that Stu isn't man enough. So then Stu's like, I'm gonna gut you in a second. And Randy starts doing this weird voice saying that he heard that they put her liver in the mailbox next to her spleen and pancreas. Sydney's freaking out. Tatum's like, I'm trying to eat here. Stu's like, oh, she's getting mad. You better leave her alone. And he's cracking up. Sydney's gone. She leaves. Billy hits him. Stu's like, what? It was a joke. So then Sydney gets home and we get to hear Sydney's lament. This is her theme and it features a woman's vocal cue, and then there's some whistling, and the whistling actually comes from Wes Craven. Another fun fact, Marco Beltrami is the composer. He was actually found because the production company went online and just was like in a chat room or like a message board, and they were like, hey, we're looking for someone to do a score for a horror movie, and that's literally how they found Marco Beltrami. So we hear Sydney on the phone with Tatum confirming that she can stay the night with her because her dad won't be home until Sunday. Tatum says that she'll pick her up soon, ask if she's okay. Sydney says that with the police and the reporters, it's like deja vu. She tells Sydney not to worry, she'll be there by 7. Sydney goes inside locking the door and packs her bag for Tatum's. She turns on the news and we see news reports about Casey and Steve. She switches channels until we see Gail talking about a year ago how Maureen Prescott was found raped and murdered. This is Sydney's mom and the true first victim of Ghostface. So if you're ever asked who was the first victim, a lot of people say Casey, and some might say Maureen. Everyone forgets about poor Steve. Sydney ends up laying down on the couch and falling asleep. She wakes up after 7 to the phone ringing. Tatum's on the line saying that practice ran late and she's on her way. She tells her to not worry because Casey and Steve didn't bite until after 10. She tells her she's going to stop at the video store and get all the right moves because if you pause it at the right point, you can see Tom Cruise's penis. Sydney tells her to hurry up and hangs up the phone. The phone rings again. She's like, Tatum, just get in the car. But instead, it is our famous,
hello, Sydney.
Tells her it's a scary night, like straight out of a horror movie. And Sydney immediately is like, oh, Randy, you gave yourself away. And asks if he's calling from work because Tatum's on her way over. He asks if she likes scary movies and she tells him that she likes that thing that he's doing with his voice and that it's sexy. He asks her favorite scary movie. She tells him she doesn't watch that shit. You know, they're all the same. It's some stupid killer stalking some big-breasted girl who can't act, who always running up the stairs when she should be running out the front door. She says it's insulting. He asks if she's alone in the house, and she tells him that that's very unoriginal and she's disappointed. He tells her, well, maybe that's because I'm not Randy. So she asks who he is. He tells her the question is not who he is. The question is, where is he? So yeah, she asks where he is. He's like, oh, I'm on your front porch. So she goes outside and calls his bluff. She goes around the porch away from the front door, and I think this is where Stu sneaks in. She asks if he can see her. He says yes. She asks what she's doing, and when he doesn't answer, she tells him to tell Tatum to hurry up and goes to hang up. He tells her that if she hangs up, she'll die just like her mother did. And then he asks if she wants to die because her mother sure didn't, and goes inside locking the door. Ghostface jumps out of the closet and goes to attack her. She fights back. He grabs her head and slams it against the ground. He takes the knife and slides it against her neck and lifts it up to kill her, and when he does, she kicks him off of her. Of course, she's chain locked the front door, so now she can't get it open. So she, of course, runs up the stairs just like the movie she hates. She runs in her room and uses the closet door to stop it from getting in. She gets on her computer and somehow dials 911 when her phone doesn't work. I have no idea how she managed to do this. Like, we had a computer back in the day, like when this movie came out, and I don't think my computer could do this. So, like, was this a super fancy computer? Is this something they made up for the movie? I have no idea. So she turns around, because of course the killer is now suddenly gone, and then Billy climbs in through the window. He's saying the front door was locked, he heard screaming, so she's like, oh my god, Billy. And of course we know it was Billy on the phone, Stu doing the attacking. So Sydney tells him the killer's in the house and that he had a knife. Billy climbs the rest of the way in the house, Sydney hugs him, and then a cell phone drops out of his pocket. Now by today's standards, that's nothing. Everybody's got a phone. But in 1996, this was a huge deal, and of course for this movie, a major red flag. So she pulls away from him, starts running into the hallway, he's chasing after her, being like, wait, 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 wait. She finally gets the front door open, runs out, and there's the ghost face mask. So she screams, Dewey screams, who is holding the mask, and he's like, oh, I found this. So Billy is then arrested. Billy tells Burke he didn't do it, he asked him to call his dad, he's yelling for Sydney, she's ignoring him. The police drive away with Billy, and Tatum arrives asking Sydney if she's okay. Dewey tries to get her to leave, and Tatum's like, no, Sydney's staying with us tonight while her dad's out of town. And of course, he's like, does mom know? She's like, yes, doofus. Which is why I think we get doofy in Scary Movie. So then Gail arrives. She's like, Jesus, get the camera! And Kenny's response is fucking hilarious because he's like, my name's not Jesus. So Gail sees Sydney driving off, tries to talk to Tatum, who calls her a pain in the ass. Kenny arrives with the camera, and Gail tells him that she realizes he's about 50 pounds overweight, but when she says hurry, that means move your fat tub of lard ass now. So at the station, Dewey's trying to look up Neil's reservation, can't find it. The cops find more info on the mask, and Dewey ends up going away with them. So Sydney's sitting by herself. She looks over and sees Billy getting questioned. In a line that is fucking hilarious now to hear, and was literally chanted out when I saw this movie at the outdoor screening, is Sheriff Burke saying, now what are you doing with a cellular telephone? And dates this movie, obviously. Burke asks what Billy was doing at Sydney's. He said he wanted to see her. Burke asks about the night before, and of course, Billy's dad has no idea he even left the house. And Billy's like, I was watching TV, I got bored, and I went for a ride. Burke asks if he happened to ride by Casey Becker's house, too, and Billy says he didn't kill anybody. And technically, at this moment, he's telling the truth. Outside of maybe Maureen, he hasn't killed anyone. Stu has. So Burke tells him that they're holding him until they get the phone records. His dad kind of has a weird, like, I don't know if it's shock or if he's, like, concerned that his son is a killer. Who knows? But Billy turns and glares at Sydney. Outside, we see Gail and Kenny have arrived. He tells her they aren't letting anyone in. She's like, I'm not just anyone, and tries to shove her way in, which, of course, they don't let her in. They take Billy to his cell, and he yells for Sydney, saying that she knows him. She knows it wasn't him. Dewey shows Burke the costume, but it's a Father Death costume that is sold at, like, every store in the state. Dewey says they're pulling phone records, but won't know anything until tomorrow. He asks Burke if he thinks that Billy did it. He says 20 years ago, not a chance, which to me is insane because 20 years ago was serial killer time where they were everywhere, but whatever. He says with these kids today, he doesn't have a clue. So Tatum asks if they can leave now and Dewey's trying to like hold her off. Of course, she's Tatum, so she raises her voice at him and she's like, I'm sorry, Deputy Dewey boy, but we're ready to go now. So he starts grabbing their stuff. Burke tells him to go out through the back to avoid the circus. And it's so great. Dewey's like, he's my superior.
Janitor's your superior.
It's one of my favorite lines. It is a brilliant ad lib by Rose McGowan. And of course, Gail knows there's a back way out of the police station. So when Dewey leaves the girls alone to bring the car around, Gail comes running up. She asks Sydney if she's okay. Tatum tries to get in between them to stop her. Sydney's like, no, she's just doing her job. And asks Gail about her book. Gail says that it'll be out later next year. Sydney says she'll look for it. And Gail says, oh, I'll send you a copy. Sydney then punches her right in the fucking face. And W. Earl Brown plays Kenny. And he said the first time they shot this scene, he was supposed to catch her. Like, that's his big thing. He's holding a camera. He's supposed to catch the TV star. And he says the first take they do it, he ends up grabbing her by the boob. And he's literally holding her boob first. And he's like, oh my God, this whole thing is so funny because if you watch the scene closely, you can see the cut where it looks like he's going to grab her boob. So I think they had to splice it all together and it's great. So we get to Tatum's house and of course she's so excited about Sydney punching Gail and she's like, Sid, super bitch. So Dewey brings in ice for Sydney's hand and tells him, I'll be just next door. Tatum asks if she thinks that Billy did it and Sydney's like, he was there. Tatum says, you know, he was destined to have a flaw because he was too perfect. So the phone rings and Mama Riley comes in telling Sydney that it's for her. She's thinking it's her dad, but Mama Riley's like, I don't think so. So Sydney grabs the phone and it's Ghostface saying that an innocent man doesn't stand a chance with her. He says it looks like she's fingered the wrong guy again. Of course, Sydney's yelling no. So Mama Riley is going to get Dewey, but he doesn't come out until after Ghostface hangs up the phone. And when he picks up the phone, he does this weird, like, hello. Just super weird. A lot of people were wondering if it was Dewey because it was like a little red herring. So we cut back to Woodsboro High. There's reporters talking about how Sydney was attacked and who Sydney is. You know, she's the daughter of Maureen Prescott, who was raped and tortured by Cotton Weary. He's cameoed briefly by Liev Schreiber. Apparently he was a favor to Bob Weinstein. He was like, hey, I have this bit part, do it real quick. So he walked on and did the role. So Cotton is apparently awaiting the death sentence. And we see that Sydney testified against him and he was the state's key witness. Dewey tells her that Billy was released and they are cross-referencing any calls made to her and Casey. They head to school and Dewey tells her that she's safe here. We have the reporter that is cameoed by Linda Blair. She's arrived asking Sydney, how does it feel to be almost brutally butchered? Sydney sees Gail and goes up to her, who's like, stop right there. Sydney's like, I'm not here to fight. I just want to talk. Gail yells for Kenny. Sydney's like, no, this is off the record. Gail refuses. Sydney's like, you owe me. Gail's like, I don't owe you shit. Sydney's like, you owe my mother. So Gail holds off Kenny. She says her mother's murder was last year's hottest court case and that someone was going to write a book about it. So Sydney says, of course, and it had to be you with all your lies and bullshit theories. Gail's like, what is your problem? Cotton's in jail. They're going to gas him. Her book's not going to change that. So Sydney asks if Gail still thinks that he's innocent. Gail's like, your testimony put him away. It doesn't matter what I think. Sydney says that Gail called her a liar during the trial and did a bunch of stories about her. And Gail's like, yeah, I think you falsely identified him. Sydney asks if she's talked to Cotton. And Gail's like, I have. Many times, his story has never changed. He admits to having sex with Maureen, but that's it. Sydney says that he's lying. She wouldn't have touched him. She says that he raped my mother and then butchered her. Her blood was all over his coat. Gail says he was drunk that night and left his coat after her mother seduced him. Sydney says that she saw him leave wearing it. And Gail says, no, you saw someone leave wearing it. The same someone who planted it in Cotton's car framing him. Sydney goes, no, Cotton murdered my mother. Gail asks if she's not so sure anymore, and Tatum compliments Gail's welt on her face, and Gail asks if the killer is still on the loose, and if Sydney thinks that the murders are related. Sydney apologizes for mangling her face. Gail tries to signal to Kenny, but Tatum's like, no, stop. So Gail is freaking out about the possibility that Cotton is an innocent man on death row. Kenny asks if they need to go live. She's like, no, we don't have any proof. So she says if she's right about this, she could save a man's life. And then in true Gale fashion, she's like, do you know what this could do for my book sales? And then lightly slaps Kenny on the cheek. Sydney tells Tatum that she should not be at school today. And Tatum's like, we'll meet right here after school. Sydney asks Stu if Billy's really pissed. And he's like, are you kidding me? After you branded in the Candyman, his heart's broken. And of course, Tatum shoves Stu. Suddenly, someone comes running down the hallway in the Ghostface costume. He's like screaming and jumping out at people. Stu's laughing, saying this place is like Christmas. Tatum gives him crap. Sydney ends up going to the bathroom. Before she can get there, she runs right into Billy. He's like, whoa, whoa, do you still think it's me? And she's like, no, someone was there. They tried to kill me. He's like, yeah, the police think that I scared him away. It wasn't me. Sydney's like, I know, he called me again at Tatum's house. And Billy's like, see, it couldn't have been me. I was in jail. And shows her his dirty ass hands. Like, first of all, if you're the number one suspect, why are you at school? Go home. And second, he's so fucking greasy in this movie. Like, he just looks dirty. And if you look at his hands, like, what the hell was he doing in that jail cell? She tells him that she's sorry. And she asks him to understand. He's like, what? Understand that you'd rather accuse me of being a killer than touching me? Fuck this dude, okay? Just fuck Billy Loomis. She tells him that's not true. And he's like, well, what is it? She's like, I was attacked. And he's like, no, about us. Like, what's the deal with us? You know, you haven't been the same since your mom died. And she's like, my mom was killed. Like, how can you be bringing this up right now? Because he's a piece of shit that only thinks with his dick, girl. Like, come on. He tells her that it's been a year, and she's like, no, a year tomorrow. He's like, you just need to get over this. When my mom left my dad, I accepted it, and she's not coming back. She's like, your parents split up. It is not the same thing. Your mom left town. She's not lying in a coffin somewhere. He apologizes, says it's a bad analogy, tells her he just wants his girlfriend back. She tells him that she is so sorry that her traumatized life is an inconvenience to him and his perfect existence. She takes off to the bathroom. He tries calling out for her. Billy fucking sucks. So, we now go to Principal Hembree's office, and he is yelling at the two students that were running around in the Ghostface costumes. And he's like, he grabs these scissors, and these scissors are huge, like, fabric scissors. Like, they make that little, like, shing sound when you open them, and they're super pointy, and, like, he's just, like, shaking them at people and shit. It's terrifying. And so he cuts up the mask, you know, saying, this is the way you show your compassion and sensitivity. And he points the scissors at one of the guys. And he turns to the other one, he's like, you're both expelled. And he goes to kick him out of the office. And they're like, what? What? That's not fair. It's a joke. So he takes the scissors and slides the pointy end down one of their shirts, saying, fair would be to hang you from a tree. And then he turns to the other one. He's like, and then we can expose you for the heartless, desensitized little shits that you are. Hembree's a little off his rocker. So we cut to Sydney. She's in the bathroom, cleaning off her face, like trying to hide the fact she's been bawling. And you hear two girls in the stall. My thing is like, were they so just like talking and shit that they didn't notice her coming? Because it seems like they weren't talking and then they started talking. So like, if you're just sitting there doing the biz, here in the U.S., like you can see through the crack of the bathroom stall. So like, did they not realize that that was Sydney Prescott, or did they just not give a shit? So one of the girls is like, I think she made it up. She wasn't attacked. Because they name check her, Sydney's like, oh shit, and goes and like hides in one of the stalls. The girl comes out and one of them's a cheerleader, and she's like, what if it's Sydney? What if she killed Casey and Steve? The other girl's like, why would she do that? The cheerleader says, well, maybe she had the hots for Steve and killed them both in a jealous rage. The other girl's asking what she would want with Steve when she has her own bubble butt boyfriend, Billy. The cheerleader's like, well, maybe she was a slut, just like her mom. And of course, Sydney's very sad. And the cheerleader's like, it's a common fact her mom was a tramp. The other girl's like, cut her some slack. She watched her mom get butchered.
And it fucked her up royally. Think about it. Her mother's death leaves her disturbed and hostile in a cruel and inhumane world. She's delusional. Where's God? Etc. Completely suicidal. One day she snaps. She wants to kill herself. But she realizes that teen suicide is out this year, and homicide is a much healthier therapeutic expression.
I did not catch this until recently. She does not say homicide. She says homicide. The other girl asks her where she gets this shit, and in a true 90s answer, the cheerleader says, Ricky Lake. And they leave laughing. Sydney comes out of the bathroom, and suddenly she hears a man whispering her name. She turns, looking around, looks under the stalls, doesn't see anything. She hears it again, but this time someone steps down from the toilets, and she starts running out of the bathroom, crying, because they jump out and try to attack her, and she slides and hits a trash can to get out. She comes running out crying, but no one chases out behind her. We cut to a reporter saying that a series of pranks at the school have occurred. This could easily be a figment of Sydney's imagination, or it was a prank, and it was just someone fucking with her in the bathroom. Because here's my thing. Those girls are in the bathroom. So was Ghostface, or this, you know, faux Ghostface, there waiting to scare the cheerleader and her friend? And Sydney just happened to walk in? Because everything happened so quickly, Sydney or the girls would have seen Ghostface come in. So he had to have already been in there. If it was the true Ghostface, Billy has already taken off. He couldn't turn around and follow her in the bathroom because we don't see him go that way. Plus, they would have caught him going in. And Stu left to go to class with Tatum. So it has to be a prank, or it's just not real and Sydney imagined it. Gail talks to Dewey and she's asking him if there's some sort of problem here. And she's kind of flirting with him. She's like, well, you're awfully young to be a police officer. And he's like, oh, I'm 25. She's like, oh, well, then I just missed you then, because I tested out, and with the demographics, I am most popular with males 11 to 24. She tells him that he doesn't look a day over 12 except for that upper torso area, and asks if the force requires him to work out. He tells her no, but because of his boyish looks, muscle mass has helped his acceptance among his peers. They hear a notice from Hembree saying that classes are now canceled. There's a citywide curfew at 9 o'clock. Gail says they must have a serial killer on their hands, and Dewey says that's not accurate because you have to knock off a few more to get that title. She asks him if they've located Neil. He says no. She asks if he's a suspect, and he tells her they haven't ruled him out as a possibility and realizes at that point that he's saying too much. And he tells her that she's much prettier in person. She's like, oh, you do watch the show. He's like, I'm 25. I was 24 for a whole year. She's then like, call me Gail. So then Tatum and Sydney are leaving school. Tatum tells her that it had to be someone playing a joke. Sydney's like, no, I know it was him. She tells Sydney she won't be alone anymore. Stu comes up and hands her this like flower, and he's thanking her for whatever she did. And there's actually a deleted scene that she goes into Hembree's office after the attack in the bathroom and is crying, and that's what prompts him to basically shut down school because he thinks that Ghostface was there. And so that's why he's thanking her, because everyone knows it's something that happened to Sydney. So he tells everyone that he's throwing an impromptu party at his house. Tatum ends up talking Sydney into going, and Stu tells them to bring food. We cut back to Hembree's office, and he's trying on the mask. Someone knocks on the door, and he jumps and rips the mask off his face. He checks the hallway. No one's there. He turns around with the mask in his hand, and he jumps at the sight of it in the mirror. Someone knocks on his door again. He goes a little further into the front office to see who it is, and he's like, you little shits. And when he says that and looks through the doorway, the guy is like, what'd you call me? He's like, oh, Fred, not you. This is actually Wes Craven in the Freddy Krueger costume, being Fred the janitor. So after that quick moment, Hembree goes back into his office, and he checks the closet to see if there's anyone in there. And if you look closely in this scene, you will catch the Fonzie jacket in the closet, because Henry Winkler played Fonzie in Happy Days. So he closes the closet, and then he closes the door to his office. And when he does, Ghostface is behind the door. So he pops out and he stabs him multiple times and he kills him. This scene was added because in the script, Dimension realized that there was 30 pages, which is about 30 on-screen minutes, where there were not any kills. So if you think about it, from Casey to Hembree, there's nothing. And it would be from Casey to, what, Kenny? No, Tatum. Tatum in the garage. So they had to add in something there. So they added in Hembree. And it also worked as a good plot device to get everyone out of the party as well. So we cut to Tatum's house. Her and Sydney are talking on the front porch about Maureen. Tatum says, you know, your dad was always away on business.
Maybe your mom was a very unhappy woman.
Sydney's like, well, then why couldn't Cotton prove it that they were having an affair?
Adam's like, you can't prove a rumor. Sydney's like, it was created by that tabloid twit Gail Weathers.
Tatum's like, it goes farther back. You know, there's been talk.
Sydney's like, so you believe it?
Tatum's like, you can only hear that Richard Gere gerbil story so many times before you believe it.
And if you don't know this, the story was that Richard Gere stuck a gerbil up his ass because he liked feeling the gerbil move in his ass. That's the big Hollywood urban legend. That's where this is coming from.
Tatum apologizes, and Sydney's like, if I was wrong about Cotton, then the killer is still out there.
Tatum tells her that she's starting to sound like a Wes Carpenter flick or something. She's like, you know, don't freak yourself out. We got a long night ahead of us.
And we see Ghostface, like, in the woods, a little far off from where they were, kind of watching them.
He takes off. We go to the video store where Randy works. He's stocking shelves. Stu sneaks up behind him and knocks the movies out of his hands. He's like, this place is packed. He invites Randy to his house. Randy's like, I'm off early. Curfew, you know.
Someone asks about a movie, and Randy says, oh, it's over here. Well, then he looks, and he sees Billy in the horror section.
And he's like, if you were the only suspect in a murder spree, would you be standing in the horror section?
Stu tells him it was a misunderstanding. Billy didn't do anything. Randy's like, oh, you little lapdog. He's got killer printed all over his forehead.
Stu's like, all right, cool, smart guy. Why'd the cops let him go?
Randy's like, this is all standard horror movie stuff.
Stu's like, well, why would he go after Sydney?
Randy's like, there's always some stupid bullshit reason to kill your girlfriend. That's the beauty of it. Simplicity. He says if you get too complicated, you lose your target audience.
Stu asks for Billy's reason specifically, and Randy says, well, maybe Sydney wouldn't sleep with him.
Now that Billy tried to mutilate her, do you think Sid would go out with me? No, I don't at all. No.
Stu tells him that he thinks it's her dad and asks why they can't find him.
Because he's probably dead. His body will come popping up in the last reel somewhere. Eyes gouged out, fingers cut off, teeth knocked out. See, the police are always off track with this shit. If they watch prom night, they'd save time. There's a formula to it. A very simple formula. Everybody's a suspect.
Randy turns around to stalk a shelf, says, you know, the dad's a red herring, it's Billy. Well, then Billy grabs him by the scruff of the shirt, asking him how they know he's not the killer. Stu comes up behind Randy, puts his arms around his shoulders, so now they've got him kind of pinned in there.
Billy's like, maybe your movie-freaked mind lost its reality button.
Randy's like, yeah, if this was a horror movie, I would be the prime suspect. Stu asks for his motive while flicking his earlobe in a really weird way. Randy says that it's the millennium, and motives are incidental. Billy tells him that's a good idea, walks away after patting Randy's cheek, being like, oh, good kid, good kid. So Billy leaves. Stu's like, oh, millennium, good word.
Randy looks terrified. He's like, are you telling me that's not a killer?
It's great. So the town starts closing everything down. They're getting ready for curfew. And we get a little bit of Right Hand Red. It was featured in the first three Scream films. And I hope it makes an appearance in Scream 2022. I was mega disappointed when it was not in Scream 4. So Sydney says that it looks like the town that dreaded sundown. And Tatum asks who would play her if they make a movie about her life. Dewey's like, I see you as a young Meg Ryan. And she tells him that with her luck, they'll probably cast Tori Spelling, which of course they do in Scream 2, and it's amazing. So Tatum and Sydney go into the grocery store while Dewey stops at the police station. Sydney asks if Billy will be there, and Tatum's like, no, I told Stu not to invite him. Sydney tells her that whenever Billy touches her, she can't relax. Girl, that is your body realizing he's a fucking psycho. So Tatum tells her, you know, you have some issues from your mom dying. Like, that's okay. You'll thaw out. Sydney tries to say that Billy has been so patient with the sex stuff when we know he has not. And Tatum, being the best friend ever, tells her that Billy and his penis don't deserve her. And she is absolutely the fuck right. Ignoring the fact that he's a psycho killer, he's a fuck boy. And no one needs a fuck boy in their life. His hand works just fine, thank you. So we see Ghostface is also somehow stalking them in broad daylight in the grocery store. Right by the fucking police station. Okay. So Dewey arrives and Burke asks where he's been. And Dewey has an ice cream cone. So it's pretty obvious he's been getting him some ice cream. So Burke confirms that the phone records have traced to Neil Prescott. Dewey asks if his phone could have been cloned.
Burke ignores it. He's like, no, no, there's more. Tomorrow is the anniversary of his wife's death, and he says that they'll keep the roadblocks and the curfews up, and if he's not found by morning, they'll start doing a house-to-house. Burke asks where Sydney is. Dewey's like, she's with my sister. Do you need to bring her in? Burke's like, no, we need to find Neil. And this scene is so distracting because Burke is trying to smoke. And I say try because I don't feel like this actor has ever smoked in his life. And so he's so unnatural with his movements. And then you have Dewey, who's like taking a nibble of his ice cream every time Burke takes a puff of his cigarette. I honest to God half expected Dewey to throw his ice cream down when Burke throws his cigarette out. But he didn't. Burke throws a cigarette down, tells him to stay close to Sydney, not to let her out of his sight. And we see Dewey taking the girls to Sue's house with Gail's van not far behind them. And now we get to the infamous scene 118. We will have more in fun facts. So the girls arrive with food. We see that Stu has a beer funnel in the kitchen. He's saying that they started without them. Gail and Kenny park a little farther back and she asks him for the camera. When he goes in the van, Dewey shows up scaring her and she tells him, you know, you never know where a story will break out. He tells her it's just a bunch of kids cutting loose. She asks what he's doing there. He says he's keeping an eye on things. He tells her he's going to look around, check out the party, and she asks to join him. She takes a little camera from Kenny and slips it in her purse. Inside, Randy is taking a poll between Evil Dead, Hellraiser. They got a bunch of horror movies. And Sydney is asking why Jamie Lee Curtis is in all of these films, and Randy tells her that she's the Scream Queen, and they start talking about movies. The doorbell rings, and Stu asks Tatum to get him another beer as he goes to the door. Stu comes back, freaking out that Gail's there. Dewey comes in and takes the beer from a guy, saying, ah, you're underage, son. And he hands it back and tells him to have a good time, because Dewey's a cheese ball. So Tatum gets Dewey's attention, and he's like, what is she doing here? He's like, oh, she's with me, like all excited, like, because he's a dork. And Tatum's like, you need to leave and take your little media mouth with you. Sydney kind of walks out of the room as Gail's going in to place the camera, which of course Sydney doesn't know that, but whatever. So Dewey walks up to Sydney, and she's asking if he found my dad. He says no. Gail ends up putting the camera right where the TV is, so she has a great view of everybody in the party. And truly, that's where I feel a lot of things, like how Stab came to be, is from this camera, because they can see and hear everything, because the kitchen is not far off from the living room based on this placement. So Sydney asks Dewey if she should be worried, and Dewey's like, not yet. Tatum goes into the garage to get a beer. She grabs a few beers out of the fridge and doesn't notice that the door to the house closes. Some stuff falls over, and of course it's a cat leaving, and it cuts through this little doggy door. So Tatum goes to the door leading into the house and tries to open it and can't. The lights go out and she knocks on the door trying to get someone's attention from the inside. She pushes the button for the garage door, starts walking towards it. Well, then suddenly it stops about halfway. She goes to go under it and it starts going down. She looks and she sees Ghostface. She asks if it's Randy. He says no. She tells him to lose the outfit because if Sydney sees it, she'll flip. But he won't let her pass into the house, and she asks if he wants to play Psycho Killer, and of course he nods yes. She's like, oh, can I be the helpless victim? And of course he nods again. She tells him, oh, please don't kill me, Mr. Ghostface. I want to be in the sequel. She tries to push past him, being like, cut it, Casper, that's a wrap. But he ends up grabbing her arm, she starts dropping the beer, and then he cuts her arm with a knife. She takes off running, he chases after her, she smacks him in the face with a freezer door. She tries to go inside but can't. She starts throwing beer bottles at him and she hits him with two of them. And in real life, Rose McGowan was supposed to throw one towards the camera. And so they had this huge X right beside the camera and that was her target. But when she threw it straight into the lens of the camera. So Tatum tries to get away and she tries to crawl through the doggy door. In real life, she could fit through the doggy door. So they had to nail her into it, like her shirt and stuff, so she wouldn't fall out. So she's trying to go through, she can't get out, Ghostface hits the button and the door starts lifting. In real life, there's no way this would have worked, but you know, movie magic and all that, we'll say this is a super engine on this fucking garage door. She just keeps lifting off the ground and eventually her neck and face get crushed in the garage door. It's truly a terrible squishy face prop, but what can you do, it's 1996. So the power goes out in just the garage somehow because Ghostface sneaks into the house and it's fully lit up. Don't know how that happened. You would think you would lose power in the entire house. But whatever. Most of the people leave for curfew and they start heading out. Sydney can't find Tatum. She yells for her and someone just yells back, "There's nobody here but us chickens." Like, what the hell? She asks him if he has seen Tatum and he's like, no. And suddenly Billy jumps out and scares everyone. Billy and Stu exchange a look and Billy asks to speak to Sydney alone. Stu tells him to go up to his parents' room to talk or whatever. Billy tells him to look up subtlety, hits him in the balls. I think this is because Billy just got hit in the balls with the beer bottle. So Sydney's like, no, it's okay. We do need to talk. She takes him upstairs. Randy sees them going and is asking Stu what Leatherface is doing here. He's like, oh, they're making up. So Randy's like, there's my chance with Sydney. He's like, I'm gonna go check on them. He never does. I don't know like where Randy went. That's, I guess, supposed to be the big thing of maybe he's Ghostface. Who knows? We cut to Kenny, who's watching everyone leave on the monitor. And when Gail comes into the van, they figure out that he's got like a 30-second delay. She's watching the footage and she asks him if a cheesy tabloid journalist has ever won a Pulitzer. He tells her there's a first time for everything. So we cut to Billy and Sydney on the bed in Stu's parents' room and he tells her that he's been selfish and apologizes. Sydney's like, no, I've been self-absorbed with my post-traumatic stress and I can't wallow in the grief process forever. And that she can't keep lying to herself about who her mother was. She says that she's scared she's gonna turn out like her, like she's a bad seed. Billy tells her that doesn't make sense and he compares to Jodie Foster's flashbacks of her dead father in Silence of the Lamb. And Sydney, of course, is like, but this is real life. This is not a movie. Billy tells her that it's all a movie, only you don't get to pick your genre. And somehow, that just fucking does it for Sydney. And she kisses him. And she's like, why can't I be a Meg Ryan movie or even a good porno? And like, I don't know what it is, but I hate the way she says porno. And also, like, Billy's kissing her neck. But when he see, like, they get on his face, it's so red and veiny. Like, what is wrong with him? And so he's like, are you sure? She says, yes. And she says she thinks so. And in breaking every horror movie rule, the virgin sleeps with her boyfriend. And of course, in this movie, the boyfriend is the killer. So we cut downstairs to see the few that are left. And they're watching Halloween, specifically Bob's death scene. And Stu asks when we're going to see Jamie Lee's breasts, and he's making a big deal out of it. Randy's like, it won't be until Trading Places in 1983. You know, Jamie Lee was always the virgin in horror movies, and that's how she outsmarted the killers. You know, only virgin can do that. And he's like, you know the rules, come on.
Jesus Christ, you don't know the rules?
Have an aneurysm, why don't you?
There are certain rules that one must abide by in order to successfully survive a horror movie. For instance, number one. You can never have sex. No. Big no-no! Big no!
I'm a dead man.
Human problem. Sex equals death, okay? Number two, you can never drink or do drugs. No, the sin factor. It's a sin, it's an extension of number one. And number three, never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
I'm getting another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back.
So Gail and Kenny are watching the footage when Dewey comes up saying someone reported a car in the bushes and asks if she wants to check it out with him. I don't understand, like, I'm assuming Billy did before he got there, but like, you don't want the cops there, which I guess Dewey you could pick off, but like, what if it wasn't, like, what if Dewey wasn't there? What if they just sent all the cops to look for this car? Then you can't pull off your murder because you've sent all the cops. No one else is giving two shits about this car. So, like, plus they're out in the middle of nowhere. Like, these houses are pretty far apart. So I just think it was super odd that someone reported this car. But I get they're reporting the car, so they find it and suspect Neil. I just think it wasn't done properly, but whatever. She obviously goes with him. They take off walking. In a really cute scene, he's like, oh, do you know what that constellation is? She's like, no, what is it? He's like, I don't know, that's why I was asking you. And it's so fucking weird, but like perfectly Dewey. So we see a few more people are leaving Stu's house and they ask him if he knows where Tatum went. And he's like, nah, she probably got pissed and bailed. The rest are finishing Halloween. We get a clip of Sydney and Billy taking off their clothes when the phone rings. Randy says that Principal Hembree was killed and was hung from the goalpost on the football field. Everyone leaves except for Randy, who's like, man, we're just getting to the good part. They all drunkenly drive off. Gale and Dewey are getting to know each other, and he's like, oh, my name is Dwight, but Dewey is this town's way of not taking me seriously. Gale's like, my name is Gale Weathers. I sound like a meteorologist, and people treat me like I'm the Antichrist of television journalism. He tells her she's not that bad, and we see the cars coming up behind them. She tells him that he's only saying that because he kind of likes her. They have to end up jumping out of the way because the cars are coming up so fast, plus they're drunk. They end up landing on top of each other, rolling down a hill. Gale kisses him, and he's like, I'm sorry, I'm on duty. She starts laughing and looks away, but she sees something and asks if that's what he's been looking for. And of course, he tells her, oh, my whole life. She ends up showing him the car. He realizes it's Neil Prescott's car, and they head back to the house where we see that Sydney and Billy are finished. He asks if she's okay. She's like, yeah, I'm fine. She asks who he called when he was in jail, and Billy says he called his dad. She tells him, no, Sheriff Burke called your dad. I was there. Billy's like, yeah, when I called him, I didn't get an answer. Billy's like, you still don't think it was me? She says, no, but if it were, it'd be a clever way of, you know, throwing me off the track. She's smiling. He doesn't think it's very funny. He asks her what he has to do to prove he's not the killer when suddenly Ghostface comes up behind him and stabs him in the chest 4 times. Billy turns around, getting blood everywhere, and collapses on the bed. Ghostface wipes the blade off and chases after her. They run through the house, going through various doors to get away. She hits him with a door. She goes through the attic. She sees Gale's van and she's like banging on the window, trying to yell for help, but he can't hear her. She goes around, opens another window in the attic, and climbs out. She's screaming for help when Ghostface grabs her. She jumps back and falls onto the boat on the ground below. When she hits the ground, she looks up and sees Ghostface is gone, but then a little further down is Tatum's dead body. We cut to Randy inside yelling, watch out, at Jamie Lee Curtis, that, you know, oh, he's behind you. Look out, Jamie, he's behind you, which of course is very meta because it's Jamie Kennedy. And of course, Ghostface is right behind him, sneaking up behind Randy. Fun fact, both Skeet Ulrich and Matthew Lillard were in the costume at different points in this scene, and I have a fun little clip from a horror convention to prove it.
Oh, yeah, this question is for both of you guys. Were either of you in the actual Scream costume, or was it like a stunt guy for you?
You know, we talked about this yesterday. I mean, 99% of it was a stunt guy who, if I'm not mistaken, was even a touch taller than Matt, who's like 6'10". I didn't realize we had done actually the same scene in the wardrobe just for fun, walking behind Jamie Kennedy while he's watching Jamie Lee Curtis.
Skeet does stuff and I want to be like him. Very.
Well, you might have done it first. Who knew?
Trust me. I was like, oh, I want to do that too.
That's how all the stabbings happened. Initially, I was just supposed to stab him and he was like, no, I want to do that too.
Stu is super gay.
And an Aquarius.
Happy Pride, everyone. Happy Pride.
So Ghostface raises the knife to kill him when Sydney starts screaming outside for help. She's breaking through a fence. She's trying to, like, knock on the van door. She wakes up Kenny. They look towards the camera and see Ghostface behind Randy. So Kenny goes to help him and sees the front door is now wide open. Because, of course, 30-second delay. So he turns back to the camera and he looks back at the house. When he does, Ghostface is there and slices his neck. Kenny points to the back of the van where there's a door, and Sydney closes the door, but of course Ghostface gets a good little stab right in the shoulder. She crawls through and gets out through the back of the van. She runs through fencing and away from the house. So Dewey and Gale have now arrived back at the house. Dewey tells her to lock herself in and call the sheriff for backup. Dewey goes inside, but of course he thinks he hears screaming, but it's Jamie Lee Curtis screaming in Halloween, and he gets scared. He's yelling for Neil. He can't find him. Of course, he now realizes it's the movie, and we cut to Gale looking for Kenny. She sees blood on the van on the ground and ends up getting in the van and closing the door behind her. She grabs the cell and starts to call 911 when Randy shows up. Well, he scares her so bad that she hits him in the face with the phone and he falls to the ground. She goes to leave, but then she sees something all over the windshield, so she turns on the windshield wipers and realizes that it's blood. She goes to leave, and when she hits the brakes to switch into drive, Kenny slides down further off of the top of the van onto the windshield so she can see him. She takes off and she yells like, Kenny, I'm so sorry, but get off my fucking windshield. But, like, I didn't know if she was, like, get off my fucking Pangea or what she was saying here, because it doesn't sound like windshield. All you do is fix that with some ADR, but whatever. So she goes to fling him off the wind, or off of the top of the van. And funny enough, when they filmed this scene, she went so fast, she did actually almost throw W. Earl Brown off of the top of the van. He had to, like, grab onto, like, the mirror and the windshield wiper and shit to hang on. Sydney comes up and she's trying to stop her so she can get in the car with her, but Gail freaks out and swerves. And when she does, she crashes into a tree down a hill. Sydney screams for Dewey, and she sees him walking out of the house. He collapses with a knife in his back. And fun fact, Dewey was supposed to die here. But test audiences loved him so much, they filmed a scene with him surviving. So Sydney gets into the cop Jeep and locks the door. Ghostface sneaks to the other door. She locks him out. She goes to start the car, realizes she doesn't have the keys. Ghostface knocks on the window with a knife and shows her that he has the keys. He slips down where she can't see him, and the doors start unlocking. So, of course, she goes to lock him back and doesn't realize that the little tailgate is lifting in the back. So police radio goes off. She gets on the radio. She's like, I'm at Sue Mocker's house. The killer's here. He's going to kill me. Ghostface grabs her, but she manages to get away. She turns around and no one's there. So she goes to go inside the house. Well, then Randy comes up running, screaming they have to get the fuck out of here. She grabs Dewey's gun and points it at him. And he's like, no, I found Tatum. I think Stu did it. Stu comes running up saying, no, don't listen to him. They both start walking towards her. She's like, get back. Stu's like, he killed Billy. He killed my Tatum. Randy's like, no, he did it. So Stu throws him down on the patio steps. He's like begging her for the gun. They both start pointing at each other. And she's like, fuck you both. And goes inside locking the door. They're both banging on the door. Randy starts screaming that Stu's going crazy. But they stop. And then Billy starts to come down the stairs. He falls down them. Sydney asks if he's okay. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm stuck like a pig, but I'm okay. He tells her they need to get help and goes to open the door. She's like, no, he's out there. Billy takes the gun from her and opens the door. Randy runs in saying that Stu's flipped out and he's gone mad. Billy says, we all go a little mad sometimes, and shoots Randy in the shoulder. And then he's like, oh, Anthony Perkins, psycho. Billy's fine. He licks the blood off his hands and he's like, ooh, corn syrup. The same thing they use for pig's blood in Carrie. So Sydney goes to run away because she's like, fuck, it's him. And here's the moment I was shocked in this movie. She ends up running into Stu. She's asking him for help. And he pulls out the voice box and says, surprise, Sydney. They're both Ghostface. I knew it was Billy. Like, I knew. Like, I've seen enough horror movies. Like, it's Billy. Billy is a creepy motherfucker. It's him. But I had no idea that it was also Stu. And I loved Stu in this movie. I thought he was ridiculous and great. So when it was revealed that not only was there two people, but Stu was also the killer, I was like, oh shit. So I remember, like, as a kid being like, mind blown. So they trap her in the kitchen. She's like, fuck you. And they're like, no, we played that game. You lost. Because they're just fucking with her at this point. Stu's like, come on, we're gonna play a game. It's a fun game. We'll ask you the questions, and if you're wrong, you die. And then Billy says, and if you're right, you die. Sydney says they're both crazy, and Stu says they prefer the term psychotic. She says they'll never get away with it. And Stu is all hugged up on Billy, watching him basically in adoration, as Billy's like, oh yeah? Tell that to Cotton Weary. He said it was very easy to frame him. Stu's like, yeah, you watch a few movies, take a few notes. It was fun. She asks why, and Billy screams why, and tells Stu that she wants a motive. He says he doesn't really believe in motives, and he thinks it's scarier without one. And in actuality, with the test audiences, this is a real life situation they were dealing with. Half the audience was like, no, it's great to not have a motive, and half the audience wanted a motive, so they satisfied both sides. And he says, you know, we did your mom a favor because she was a slutbag whore who flashed her shit all over town like she was Sharon Stone or something. And Stu chimes in and he's like, you know, we put her out of her misery because let's face it, your mother was no Sharon Stone. And I fucking love how he says it. It's so funny. So Billy asks if that's motive enough for her. And he goes, well, your slut mother was fucking my father. And that's why my mom moved out and abandoned me. and Stu is standing there in shock, so it is fairly obvious that he had no fucking clue. Billy says, you know, abandonment will cause serious deviant behavior, and it fucked her up, causing her to have sex with a psychopath. And Stu says, yeah, you're no longer a virgin, so now you have to die, because those are the rules. He tells her it's a scary movie and asks how it's going to end. And Stu starts screaming, oh yeah, this is the best part. And, you know, it's a scream, baby. And he goes in the hallway, and Billy's like all hugged up with Sydney, and he's like, it's after midnight, congratulations. We killed your mom a year ago today. Stu brings Neil out and puts the voice changer and the cell phone in his pocket, saying that they don't need those anymore. He tells her they cloned his cell, and that Billy says on the anniversary of his wife's death, Neil went on a murder spree, killing everyone. Stu says that Billy and him are left for dead. Billy says that he kills Sydney and then shoots himself in the head for a perfect ending. Stu's like, I thought of that. Billy tells her to watch this. And Stu raises his arms and he's like, yeah, man, get up, get it up, get it up. And I didn't pay attention to what he was saying here until Scream 4. And I'll explain that when we get there. So Billy stabs Stu in the side, and then Stu grabs a knife. Billy's like, stay to the side and don't go too deep. He's like, oh yeah, I'll remember, because of course Billy stabbed him too hard. So then he stabs Billy. Billy yells at him. He's like, oh, I must have got a little zealous. So Billy yells for him to give him the knife. Stu refuses, and Stu's like, everyone dies. Everybody dies except for us, because we get to live to carry on and plan the sequel, because these days, you gotta have a sequel. So Billy stabs Stu a few times. Sydney says they're sick fucks who've seen too many movies. Billy tells her not to blame the movies. You know, movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative. He stabs Stu again and again, and Stu tells him to stop because he can't take it anymore, and he's feeling a little woozy here. So Billy tells him to get the gun, and he'll untie Neil. So Stu goes to get the gun, and it's gone. Matthew Lillard actually ad-libbed this, Houston, we have a problem line. So Gail has the gun, and Billy says that he thought she was dead. Stu's like, she looked dead, and still kind of does. Gail says that she has an ending for them. The news reporter left for dead in the van comes too. She stumbles upon these two dipshits, finds the gun, and foils their plan and saves the day. And Sydney's like, oh, I like that ending. And you have to watch Stu here, because he goes and looks at her and gives her this look like, bitch, seriously? And it's so funny. So Billy smiles at Gail, saying he knows something she doesn't know. He walks towards her, and suddenly she can't fire the gun. He kicks her in the stomach, she hits the pillar on the porch, and falls onto Dewey passed out. Stu's like, yeah, man, from the kitchen in solidarity. Billy tells her that it works better with the safety off and cracks his neck in this super weird way. He says, this is Gail Weathers signing off, and Stu turns to Sydney saying, oh, baby, you're gonna love this. He realizes she's gone, he's like, oh, shit. Billy is fed the fuck up at this point. He's just like, what? He doesn't shoot Gail. Sydney and Neil are actually both gone. So Billy starts looking for her. Stu's coughing up blood and the phone rings. Fuck.
Should I let the machine get it?
It's fucking great. So it ends up being Sydney. She's asking if they're alone in the house. Of course, Billy's like, bitch, you bitch. She's like, we're gonna play a game. Guess who just called the cops on your sorry motherfucking ass? Stu drops to his knees. Billy's like, go find her. And he's like, you got me too deep. I think I'm dying over here. So Billy gives Stu the phone. And he's like, talk to her, talk to her. And he goes to look for her. Stu's like crying and stuff and just not having a good time. And she's like, Stu, what's your motive? He's like, oh, it's peer pressure because I'm far too sensitive. So Billy comes back and he's like, I'm gonna rip you up just like your mother. She's like, you're gonna have to find me first, you pansy-ass mama's boy. And he throws the phone. And it's the best, like, second best ad-lib line. Because they're so fucking slick from all this blood and shit that they're caked with. So when he went to toss the phone to him, it slipped out of his hands and he really hit Matthew Lillard in the head with the phone. So when Matthew Lillard, as Stu, turns, he's like,
you hit me with the phone, dick!
It was a real comment that Wes Craven had to keep in. So Billy goes into like the living room, and he's like breaking shit, ripping pillows. And of course when he rips the pillows with the amount of blood on him, the feathers go all over his arm, so he looks like fucking Chicken Man. It's so goofy. So then Stu picks up the phone, and here's the best line. Like, one of my favorite lines, period, in this movie, but it's the best ad-lib line right here. Matthew Lillard, fucking incredible.
Did you really call the police?
You missed your sorry ass, I did.
My mom and dad are gonna be so mad.
And it's so fucking funny. Billy is losing his shit. Halloween's still on, so we're at the closet scene, so you hear, like, the hangers banging around. So Billy thinks she's in the closet. He goes to open it, and Sydney waits for him to look away, because when she does, she jumps out of the closet in the Ghostface costume and stabs him with an umbrella. She goes to stab him again, and the take here that is used is actually Skeet Ulrich getting injured. He had had heart surgery as a kid, so he has like a wire in his chest, and Neve Campbell managed to hit him right in the wire. And this is not the only time in this series where she really injures a Ghostface killer, but more on that later. So Billy falls to the ground, she rips off the costume, throws the gun away, when Stu comes running out of the kitchen and tackles her. She knees him in the groin, he hits her, he knocks her over the couch, climbs on top of her yelling, "I always had a thing for you, Sid." She bites him, hits him with a vase, and then she stands up and grabs the TV and says, "In your dreams," and throws the TV on his head. Now, these are not the TVs of today. These motherfuckers were a good 50 pounds. Like, they were stout. They weren't flat. Like, we're talking a full 3D big-ass TV. Now, before we freak out saying there's no way he would survive that, he's supposed to survive that, but we'll get to that. Apparently, both the "Thing for You, Sid" and the "In Your Dreams" lines were ad-libs as well. Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson were very okay with letting their actors play with their lines. And that's why a lot of the really great moments are ad-libbed. So Sydney walks over to Billy's body and grabs the mask. Randy jumps up and apologizes for scaring her. She tells him that she thought he was dead, and he's like, "I never thought I'd be so happy to be a virgin." So Billy punches him in the face, climbs on top of Sydney with a knife. He starts choking her and says, "Say hello to your mother for me." So Sydney sticks her finger in the hole that she left with the umbrella. He goes to stab her. Gil shoots him in the chest, saying, "I remembered the safety that time." Sydney helps Randy up. They take the gun from Gail. Randy tells her to be careful, because this is the moment when the supposedly dead killer comes back to life for one last scare. Billy sits up, and Sydney shoots him in the forehead, saying, "Not in her movie." There's a loud bang, everybody screams, but it's Neil trying to get out of the closet. We see the police are there finally, it's daylight, they're taking Dewey out on a stretcher, he gives a thumbs up. Gail's reporting from the house, still covered in blood, like, got a stocking all fucked up, like, she's ready. And she's like, "I have an exclusive eyewitness account." She starts walking through with the crew, telling their story. We pan up to Stu's house and then fade away to a shot of the landscape of Woodsboro. Right before the credits, we get a quick flash of Ghostface. And that's the movie. I love Scream. But now, long part of the episode, we're gonna go over fun facts. I gotta thank HelloSydney.com, Scream Obsessed on Twitter. I also snagged a few fun facts from the Still Screaming and Inside Story horror documentaries. So first, we've got our cameos. I've mentioned most of them. We've got Wes Craven as Fred the Janitor with his Freddy Krueger outfit from A Nightmare on Elm Street. Linda Blair was an insensitive reporter. Lisa Beach is a casting director. She's also a reporter. Henry Winkler plays Principal Hembree as an uncredited role. They actually asked him to do it uncredited, so his name didn't outshine the new actors. And then we have Lisa Canning from Entertainment Tonight, who plays a reporter. And I want to go over the deaths and the attacks. Like I said earlier, I have some thoughts on who killed who. Before the film, we have Maureen dying. This is Billy and Stu, and I want to say that it kind of has to be more Billy than Stu. Because if we're going off of what Roman said, he showed Billy his movie of his dad having an affair with Sydney's mom, and so he gets a little pissy and really, you know, does it upright. So then I think Steve and Casey were killed by Stu. Like I said, I think that it was Casey recognizing Stu. I think it's Billy's mannerisms on the phone. I'm gonna stick with it. So Sydney's attack at her home is Stu on the inside and Billy on the phone, just like with Casey. Sydney's call at Tatum's is obviously Stu. And I think the school bathroom prank, or the school, the ghost face attack in the bathroom at school is a prank. So then we get to Principal Hembree. Stu was with Tatum and Sydney, telling, like, inviting them to the party and all this, and they go to the grocery store and he leaves. But I think Billy is still in the school. And so I think Billy is the one who killed Principal Hembree. And then I think he and Stu both hung his body up later. Tatum is obviously Billy because Stu's entertaining. Kenny the cameraman has to be Stu because I think Billy is playing dead while there's still a lot of people in the house or around the area. Because, you know, Jamie Kennedy is unaware that Ghostface is there. He just thinks, you know, everybody's left. So I feel like that has to still be Stu. But I think Dewey's death, or attack rather, is Billy because he knew about Gail looking dead. So they had to convene at some point. And plus then you have Randy outside trying to hide from Stu. Of course, Stu is killed by Sydney. Billy is killed by Sydney as well. So now, a little more fun facts. Scream was written by Kevin Williamson after he was house-sitting for a friend. He was watching a news report about the Gainesville Ripper. The Gainesville Ripper was a murderer and a rapist who murdered 5 students in 1990 in Gainesville, Florida, and a family of 3 in Shreveport, Louisiana. While watching this report, Kevin Williamson heard a noise, and when he went into the living room, he noticed that there was a window open. He'd been in his house for 2 days and never noticed that window was open. So he called a friend and had him stay on the phone with him as he went through the house to make sure no one was there. They eventually started discussing horror movies and quizzing each other. 3 days later, the script is done. Of course, there's a huge bidding war in Hollywood over the script. It came down to Miramax, who was starting to mention films, and Oliver Stone. But Kevin Williamson found out that Miramax was interested, and even though the price was lower than the others, Kevin accepted the $400,000 check, and Scary Movie was underway. Yes, Scream was originally called Scary Movie, but Bob Weinstein wanted to change the name to Scream after the Michael and Janet Jackson video came out. Now, they just need a director. So originally, Wes Craven declined to do the film. He declined like 3 times. They also asked Sam Raimi, George Romero, Robert Rodriguez, but they kept coming back and asking Wes. Once Drew Barrymore signed on as Sidney Prescott, he changed his mind. And also a kid at a horror convention told him that he needed to do another kick-ass movie because his work was getting soft. So thank you, random kid at a horror convention. So depending on who you talk to, it was either scheduling conflicts, Drew Barrymore didn't want to do this big-ass horror movie and be a lead, or she's just a fucking genius, she switched to Casey Becker. The story goes that she called and requested to be girl number one, saying that it would mean that anything could happen in this movie, and she would still agree to promote the movie as if she was the star. Molly Ringwald, Reese Witherspoon, Alicia Silverstone, Melissa Joan Hart, Brittany Murphy, and basically every other girl in Hollywood was considered for the role of Sydney, until Neve Campbell came along. Kevin Patrick Walls, who eventually played Stephen Orth, also auditioned for Billy, as well as Justin Whaling, who even did a screen test with Neve Campbell. Joaquin Phoenix was also in consideration for Billy, but he ended up turning the role down. Rebecca Gayhart was almost Tatum, but she opted to do Somebody's Waiting instead, which I've never even heard of that movie. Rose McGowan actually dyed her naturally dark hair blonde for this film because she thought that they wouldn't want 2 brunettes leading the film. But, you know, Scream tends to prefer they're brunettes. You know, Neve and Courtney have been going through this series the whole time. Never been a big deal. The blondes tend to die. Freddie Prinze Jr. was almost Stu, and funnily enough, Matthew Lillard was actually cast because he was with his girlfriend who was a casting assistant in the same building. He auditioned for Billy because that's the part they thought that he should be, but he ended up working out for Stu. Jason Lee was in consideration for Randy, and it came down to Breckenmeyer and Jamie Kennedy, which of course Jamie Kennedy got it. David Arquette was originally offered one of the main student parts, but he requested to be Dewey. And Dewey was originally written to be this like meathead cop instead of the lovable goofball we all know and love. The incredible Janine Garofalo actually turned down the role of Gail Weathers, and Brooke Shields almost had the role, but it ended up going to Courtney Cox. Roger L. Jackson is the voice of Ghostface, And something that you may not be aware of is that he didn't, like, record his stuff later. They had him on set the entire time to interact with the actors, but they had him in a back room away from everybody, watching everything on a monitor. And he had this little phone box thing where he would actually call the phone and talk to them in real time. They even had a small on-set accident where there was, like, a power surge and the phone box that they were using wasn't plugged in correctly. So when Drew Barrymore is dialing 911 over and over again in the middle of the shoot, the phone starts ringing. They're like, what the fuck? Why is the phone ringing? And it's because she'd been actually calling 911 over and over again, screaming and hanging up. So then they had to figure out the costume, which in the script is just a ghost costume. So lots of drawings and boxes are coming to the set even during the first few days of filming. And while location scouting, they found the mask on a bedpost in one of the bedrooms. Dimension approved the mask, and K&B worked on creating their own version because they didn't own the rights to the mask.
Have you guys ever had anybody show up to your house on Halloween in the mask?
Fortunately, my house you can't get to. It's just
I think
a
he's
minute.
Challenging all the weirdos in the room. You can come over to my house, no problem.
His address is.
No, you know what's funny is that the mask, interestingly enough, so we were on set and they didn't have a mask. They thought they had a mask, but then they lost the right to the mask. So in the first 5 days of shooting, every day Wes would receive a box of masks. What about this one? What about this one? What about this one? So on one of the days, up comes this Scream mask. He's like, what do you guys think about this? And when, like, sort of everyone was passing around and sort of had an opinion that it was kind of cool. Like, you'd never seen anything like it. And the mask was from a little company in North Carolina. So back in the 90s, they weren't necessarily as... First of all, nobody thought the Scream franchise would... They just finished doing number 5. Like, nobody thought it was a franchise. We were a little horror movie that nobody ever really cared about, right? That's the thing about our movie that was so
beautiful. Yeah. Fuck them.
You know, because Wes hadn't made a bunch of movies, but he hadn't made a good horror movie in a while. I can say that, right?
Yeah, or you can say
it
that.
It wasn't a... And the genre kind of had taken a dip. Anyways, long story, way too long. The mask shows up. This little company in North Carolina had made it, and nobody had acquired the rights to the mask from that company. So the week it came out, it became a huge hit. And, or not the first week, actually, it was like the third week.
Oh, yeah, 2-3 weeks in, we
knew. It took a while for the movie to hit, but nobody acquired the mask. So that North Carolina company still owns the rights to that mask, which, if you can imagine, is $1 billion. So that,
wow.
that little company is winning.
So good we got a cut of that.
So then they had to figure out the actual robe, and at first they were going to go with white for this, like, ghost-like appearance. However, they were worried that Ghostface was going to look like a member of the KKK, so they changed it to black. Added a little sparkle, and eventually covered the entire body. So in the spring of 1996, they're ready to begin filming. Wes Craven wanted to film in California, but Dimension wanted to film in Vancouver. Wes is like, if you're gonna film in Vancouver, I'm not in. So they decided to let Wes have his way, and they found a location in Santa Rosa, California. There was a high school that had been used before, so they didn't see that it would be an issue with filming in the school. The school's admin is welcoming at first, because they joked that they had heard the principal gets killed in the film, so they were very into it. But weeks into pre-production, the school board decides they want to read the script first. They claim they were told it was a spoof, and it obviously is not. The problem is that this county had had a tragedy in 1993 where Polly Klass was kidnapped at knife point from a slumber party. Polly was found murdered, and the trial had just begun around the time that the filming was beginning. At a town hall, most of the town rejected the film and kept using violent films as the reason why they didn't want it filmed there. And there's actually a quick credit at the end of the film that says no thanks whatsoever to the Santa Rosa City School District Governing Board, because they considered it like a witch hunt. It wasn't just this movie wants to film here. They were like, these people are bad people and they're inciting violence and all this shit. So the first 5 days of filming were devoted to the opening scene with Drew Barrymore. Dimension did not care for the costume at first. They rushed through editing the opening to show the production company after Dimension requested dailies with different masks each time. To keep Drew terrified, Wes kept telling her stories of animal cruelty to upset her. And where we talked about the scene 118, basically everything at Stu's house is scene 118. It was a grueling and bloody 21-day shoot. And they even had shirts made that said, I survived scene 118, and I want one so bad. Apparently, the cast went and burned their wardrobe after all the scenes were shot, because they reported 50 gallons of blood were used to film this movie. I went to a horror convention a few years ago where most of the cast was all together talking about the movie, and they talked about how in between filming they would party during the day because they're shooting all night, and they even talked about Club Arquette, which was David Arquette's hotel room where they would go and drink and throw parties. Once they were done filming and they were putting it all together, the NPAA really came down hard on Scream, and they tried to rate this movie as NC-17, which is absolutely the kiss of death for most movies, especially a horror film. Like I said earlier, they wanted Steve Orth's cut because you could see his innards falling out. They had to speed up the close-up on Casey Becker's body. Apparently Tatum's death was also much more graphic. And the end scene with Billy and Stu stabbing each other was very graphic and didn't focus on Sydney as much. They had a lot of issues with moving blood, and so you see Matthew Lillard's hand at one point, you see a close-up on Neil Prescott. In the original version, his blood is dripping down his hand and it's dripping onto the ground. You can hear it. Well, because you see it, they considered it moving blood and they're like, no, that has to be cut. Wes Craven wrote in multiple times saying, you know, it's art, it's self-expression, you know, First Amendment. And eventually Bob Weinstein just talked to the MPAA and was like, it's a comedy. And they got their R rating. Now, as much as I hate to give credit to the Weinsteins, they were very smart in their release date. Scream was released during the week of Christmas for basically the horror fan with nothing to see. The sequel released less than a year later, also in December. The next two were February and May respectively, and Scream 5, aka Scream 2022, will be releasing in January, which is usually where the films you think will bomb go. But I have to hope that we are in for an incredible sequel. It did take a bit for the original to pick up steam, but word of mouth was incredible. It came out in December, and in May was still in theaters. They were actually doing pre-production on Scream 2, which was called Scream the Sequel, while the original Scream was still in theaters. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about some of the controversies with Scream. There were some, like, copycat killers, and this will go beyond this, like, we're going to go all the way to 2001 here. I'm going to go over a couple of instances. We've got January of 1998, 16-year-old Mario Padilla and his 14-year-old cousin Samuel Ramirez stabbed Mario's mother 45 times, killing her. The case became known as the Scream Murder and fell under intense media scrutiny after the boys claimed they were inspired by Scream and Scream 2. They would also admit to needing the money acquired from her murder to fund a killing spree and purchase two Ghostface costumes and a voice changer used by the characters in the film. During the trial, psychologist Madeline Levine, who studied the effect of violence on children, stated there's a whole bunch of reasons why they acted out that way. The case is expected to highlight the effect of violent films on teenagers, but the presiding judge ordered that the evidence pertaining to Scream be barred and that the case not be referred to as the Scream Murder, refusing media access to the courtroom, intending that the case was tried as murder and nothing else. On January 17th, 1999, 13-year-old Ashley Murray was stabbed multiple times in the head and back before being left for dead by then-friends Daniel Gill and Robert Fuller, who were 14 and 15. He was later found and saved by an elderly man walking his dog. The pair were dubbed the Scream Attackers after it emerged that they had watched Scream shortly before the attack and drawings of Ghostface masks were found among their possession. Though their actions were additionally blamed on physical abuse, drugs, and exposures to black magic in their home life, Murray, who later testified against the pair, himself stated that he believed the film may have influenced the pair to attack him. On May 4th, 1999, following Columbine High School shooting and increasing news media scrutiny on the effects on society of violence in films, games, and other media, the United States Senate's Commerce Committee held a hearing about Hollywood's marketing of films to youth and the horror genre of films in particular, using the opening scene of Scream featuring the murder of Casey Becker and is an example of negative media which may be viewed by children. In November 2001, Belgian Thierry Jardin grabbed a Ghostface mask and costume, murdered 15-year-old Allison Camber after she rejected his romantic advances. He was 24, mind you. He later claimed to the police that the murder was premeditated and inspired by the film trilogy. The following year, a 17-year-old French youth identified only as Julian, following prior failed attempts with other girls, lured a fellow pupil to a secluded spot and stabbed her to death after showing her his ghost face mask. French authorities at the time claimed the murder as the third Scream-related killing since 2000. So there have been lots of people that have said that Scream is the problem, and that's part of why, which we will get into it a little bit more with Scream 3, there was a lot of topic about violence in movies and things like that, and censorship and things like that, because around the time of Scream 3, there was a lot of information about people claiming they did it because of Scream. I'm of the mindset that people murder because they murder, and it's not violence in movies that causes that. Because I'm gonna be honest, I have watched horror movies as far back as I can remember. Like, I've had people ask me what I think, and I think I talked about it, like, what, one of my first horror movies, I remember seeing Jason's heart being eaten when it's like Jason goes to hell. And I remember on Halloween, we would go and watch horror movies in a big group with my family. Like, I have watched these movies since I was very, very small. Not once have I ever thought, hey, let me just go on a killing spree. I've watched this shit since I was a kid, because that's insane. People look for excuses to explain away their actions, in my opinion. I don't think that it is, here you go, I watched this movie about someone murdering someone, now I know what to do. Like, if that's the case, then you can't show half the shit in our reality on the news. You can't show war. You can't talk about these mass shootings and all this shit that's on the news with violence. Because if the movies are bad, real life's worse, because that's real people doing it. So let's not talk about that either. And also, Scream's my favorite fucking movie. So, like, I think it's ridiculous to blame something like Scream for a person's actions. What do you guys think? Do you love Scream? Do you hate Scream? Please don't tell me you hate Scream. It might hurt my heart. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me all over social media. I am on Twitter and Instagram at TerrorTPod. That is right. I have given up reaching out to these dead accounts that are using the name that I wanted. So we are just now TerrorTPod. So it's Terror, TerrorTTA, Pod, P-O-D, TerrorTPod. We're also on Facebook and the TerrorT group. You can catch horror news, updates on the podcast, all kinds of fun stuff over there. Come join us. If you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to the podcast. And if you really like it, please leave me a 5-star review. Again, I'm your host, Tara, and this has been Terror Tea.